Chapter 8. Relationship Change, Creating It, and Coping With It. Two of the most difficult questions I get asked when I teach about the science of sexuality are, I like these ideas, but how do I get my partner on board with the changes you're describing? Nothing you're saying will help us until we resolve this old hurt that just will not heal. How do we get past that? Both of these questions are, at their core, how do we change? And change is plenty hard when there's just one person involved. But if change requires two people to collaborate, so much more difficult. Let's notice, before we go any further, that the question is, how do we change? Not, how do I change my partner? Or, how do I change for my partner? Like, how do I convince my partner to change their mind about planning sex? Or, how do I get my partner to just let go of that stuff that happened in the past? Unlike relationships we don't expect to last into the distant future, long-term relationships require effective strategies for changing together. I want to show you how partners I know have answered these questions using the tools we've discussed in the last few chapters. I'll also add some science about how humans create intentional change. Specifically, we only change a little at a time, and it's normal for old hurts to keep hurting, even when the hurt has healed. How do I get my partner on board? One of the most common questions I get from people who have read Come As You Are or attended a workshop by themselves is, this is great. I can see how it might even be life-changing. But so far, my partner has only responded negatively when I've brought it up. How can I get them on board? The short answer is, be curious about where they are right now. You're already normal. And if you turn with calm, warm curiosity toward whatever it is that's happening in your sexual connection, regardless of whether it matches your expectations or not, you're already doing it perfectly. There is no urgency. The stakes are low. A long-term relationship is hardly ever at risk because of a sex issue per se. If there's a true threat to a relationship, it's nearly always some other issue that manifests itself in the sexual connection. Save urgency for the problems where you truly have something to lose, like disagreements about money, children, or health issues, which can have immediate and life-altering consequences. When you want to get your partner on board with a change to your erotic connection, it's often helpful to have a realistic idea of how people change. So let's talk about that. As neuroendocrinologist Robert Sapolsky puts it, you can't reason someone out of something they were never reasoned into. Facts might not care about anyone's feelings, but also feelings don't care about anyone's facts. Soliciting your partner's collaboration on some change in your sexual relationship is never a practice in convincing them or trying to persuade them. It's never about them being wrong and you being right, or vice versa. Too often, when we want our partners to change, we have a vision of that change process that goes from A to B, like this. Today, my partner thinks, feels, or does this old set of reactions. Tomorrow, after they listen to me and understand my point of view and agree that I am correct, they will think, feel, or do a new set of actions that align with what I think, feel, or do. And that is almost never how it works. Rather than A to B, it's more like A to E with all the steps in between. In public health jargon, we call it readiness to change. And readiness comes in roughly five stages: pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and maintenance. When you approach a partner to ask for change, to get them on board, rather than trying to get them from A to E all in one step, just aim to get them one step further in their readiness. Let's take each stage in turn and consider what helps to move someone one more step. Stage one, pre-contemplation. This person isn't even considering change. You'll hear them use sustained talk, which is language that indicates that the situation is not worth changing or can't be changed. Things are fine. We're too busy to worry about this right now. We've already tried. Let's give it a rest. Let's normalize pre-contemplation. We spend almost all of our time neither interested in nor ready for change around almost all of our beliefs and behaviors. There is nothing wrong with a person who is not ready for change. Intentional change can be difficult, and our lives are plenty hard without adding more change on top. Indeed, partners who are already on board for change might still not be ready. As the deadline for this book approached, my interest in sex vanished into a black hole of irony. My spouse and I simply accepted that I did not have the wherewithal even to discuss being interested in sex. We looked at the calendar and agreed, we'll talk about it on this date after the book is done. Partners who bring a child into their lives can do the same thing. We will check in again on this topic in X weeks or months. But if your partner is both uninterested in change and not yet on board, try not to judge their resistance to change. Instead, be curious about it. You might even say things like, I can understand why you wouldn't be interested in even just talking about this. Or, if it weren't so impactful on me, I wouldn't want to change either. When a partner is in pre-contemplation, it's an exercise in trust, being there for your partner right where they are without pushing. You can be there without pushing because, given the luxury of time that comes with a long-term relationship, you can allow change to happen rather than forcing it. Because it's a long-term relationship, by definition, you have time to breathe and allow your partner to be where they are. If the relationship is at stake and you can't get your partner on board, the change you're seeking is not really a change in the sex. Time to adapt the questions from chapter one. What is it that I want when I want this change to our sexual connection? If they do not have some basic information that would let them know that their life could be improved if they explored change, you can try offering them that basic information, as in, I'm listening to this book that says some things I've never considered before about sex in long-term relationships. I don't know how much of it is relevant to us, but can I tell you about an idea that sounds interesting? Or, now might not be the right time for us to try to change anything, but we'd both like things to change someday. So I've been learning a little about the science. If you're interested, I can tell you some of the new things I'm reading. And in the meantime, admiration. Admiration is often a great place to begin a change conversation. Nothing lowers defenses and opens someone's heart to a difficult conversation like authentic praise and gratitude for all the things they do right. In terms of a change conversation, explicit and genuine admiration also enhances your partner's sense of autonomy, reducing any sense of being criticized, which would only increase defensiveness. Stage two, contemplation. This person has become interested in change. They're considering what it might be like to change or what steps they might take if they decided to create change. It's often triggered by a specific major event or by a long accumulation of many minor, to them, events. You'll hear them use change talk, which is language that shows that change potentially is on the table for them. That's something we might try in the future. This is important. I think we could make it happen. After what happened last week, I feel like we're ready. To facilitate a partner's transition from pre-contemplation, it's helpful to ask questions that amplify the advantages of change and disadvantages of the status quo. We're asking questions rather than explaining because our goal is to increase our partner's interest in change, not tell them why they should be interested. Advantages of change questions? What would be some good things about? If you could wave a magic wand and make things change immediately, what would change and how would your life be better? Disadvantages of the status quo questions. What difficulties or hassles or struggles have we had when it comes to? How has this stopped us from having the life or relationship we want? What might happen if we don't change? Stage 3. Preparation. This person is almost ready for change. They're making plans and taking steps to get ready for change. They may be reading books or articles about the change or initiating conversations with people who've been through similar change. They might perceive themselves as already changing, and to some extent they are. You'll hear planning talk. If you're listening to this book, you might be in preparation. If your partner gave you this book, they might want to help you transition from contemplation to preparation. And it's working. The goal of transitioning from contemplation to preparation is to transform interest into intention. A conversational approach to helping a partner make the shift is to ask questions that enhance their intention or commitment to change. Intention to change questions. How important is this change to you or us? What might you or we be willing to try? If you or we were going to make a plan for change, what would it be? The if here respects the other person's autonomy. You are not forcing them to plan. You're simply contemplating a hypothetical plan together. Stage 4. Action. This person is actively creating change, altering behavior patterns, adjusting and adapting to a new reality. You're not just learning about responsive desire, you're adjusting your bedroom like the way my partner and I made a sex towel drawer. You're not just talking about the emotional floor plan, you're actually mapping yours and helping each other transition into spaces closer to the lust space. To facilitate a partner's transition from preparation to action, it's helpful to ask questions that amplify your shared confidence in the change. Optimism about change questions. How confident are we that we could create this change if we chose to? What personal strengths do we have that will help us succeed? Who can offer us support? What steps do we take if we feel stuck? At this stage in the change process, admiration, admiration, admiration. Look at you go. Even when you try things that don't work out, you're doing it. You're exploring new things, experimenting, playing together. Say your admiration for your partner and your relationship out loud. Heck, I admire you for getting this far. Stage 5, maintenance. This person has changed and is actively using their new skills and awareness to sustain that change across new and varied situations. To help a partner transition from action to maintenance, keep communication open with consistent, mutual feedback about the change. Feedback about change questions. What's working? What's your favorite thing about the change? Is anything not working? What could be better? Apply the sex-positive definition of perfect here. This new pattern you've established may not be everything you had in mind when you began, but you're still within the cycle of woundedness to healing, and wherever you are in the cycle is perfect. Intentional change happens when and only when people are ready, willing, and able to change. Sometimes, though, the energy people bring to the "how do I get my partner on board" question is, "My needs are not being met, and I urgently require my partner to change so that my needs will be met." Since your urgency doesn't change the reality that your partner will need time and help to transition into the change, you can manage your feelings by being curious about them. Return to that scenic viewpoint in your emotional floor plan and observe your urgent need for change without judgment and without buying into it. The great thing about long-term relationships in which you've decided to stay together till death do you part and stuff is that you have time for the situation to change gradually. The situation was probably created gradually, settling into its current state after months or years. Changing the situation may also take months or years. When the change feels too urgent for patience, be curious about the urgency. What's really at stake if things don't change more quickly? Mike and Kendra. Kendra and Mike were trying to move away from a focus on desire and instead focus on co-creating a context that emphasized pleasure. They went to a sex coach who used an approach called motivational interviewing, which leverages the stages of change, accepting where people are, and fully supporting their autonomy. It promotes thinking about change without creating pressure or expectation to change. After establishing some simple ground rules, here's what that conversation sounded like, with the bickering edited out for simplicity. Coach: let's start by making sure coaching is a good fit for you rather than therapy. Is your relationship at stake here? Would either of you end the relationship if your sexual connection doesn't change? Mike and Kendra: oh, no, definitely not. We love each other. We want to be together. We value each other as people, as co-parents, as friends. We've lived with this for so long. A few more years won't change that. Coach: okay, so you're here because you're interested in exploring change, but no matter what happens, at least for the middle-term future, neither of you is in so much distress that you'd be motivated to end the relationship. Is that right? Mike and Kendra: yes. And actually, it's nice to remember that and to be assured of that by each other. Coach: fantastic. So let's start by making a list. What are some of the good things about where you are now in terms of your sexual connection? Mike and Kendra: Coach: would it be easier to start with some of the not so good things about where you are right now? Mike and Kendra: yes. We're not having sex very often, and we've been fighting about how often we have sex since our preschooler was a fetus. That frustration leaks out into other parts of our lives, like a kind of generalized resentment and frustration and dissatisfaction. It's harder to appreciate each other when it feels like everything is somehow tied to whether or not we're having sex. And it's so easy to resent each other over small things, when what we're actually resenting is this permanent, not permanent, just long-standing battle. It's like it's transformed from being about sex to being about power and who's right and who's being listened to and taken seriously. Also, Mike feels really lonely without the sex, and Kendra feels really guilty about it. But also, we both feel resentful. Very, very resentful. Okay, good list. If you think of other things, we can always add to it. How about some good things, though? Some good things about where you are now? Mike and Kendra: we do actually have sex sometimes, and we both enjoy it. Sometimes it's amazing. We also like how we feel after we have sex that we had because we were both into it, compared to the sex we have when Kendra's just doing it out of obligation or guilt. It actually does nice things for us as a couple when we're connecting sexually. We feel closer. Coach: okay, another great list. When you look at these two lists side by side like this, what do you notice? What do you see? Mike and Kendra, well, there's more stuff on the not-so-good side. It looks like the problem really is the lack of feeling nurtured and supported, the guilt, and maybe above all, the resentment. There's so many hurt feelings for both of us. Coach, and when you think about all this, what are some strategies you might use? And maybe there are strategies you're already using to get the good stuff and maybe minimize some of this not-so-good stuff. Mike and Kendra, we really need to address the mutual resentment, which has grown so far beyond just sex. And we have to keep trying to focus on how much pleasure we experience when we do. That's something we're doing right. Coach, it's pretty hard to create a context that facilitates pleasure while you're still carrying all that resentment around in your bodies. And Mike, you might have to heal your resentment without first getting the sex you've been longing for. Mike and Kendra, oof, this is a project. Coach, yes. Okay, good work so far. If you were going to create change to get all this good stuff and minimize some of the not-so-good stuff, it sounds like you might try addressing each person's resentment outside of a sexual context and in parallel, try increasing pleasure also outside of a sexual context. Does that sound right? Mike and Kendra nod in agreement. With the help of the coach, Mike and Kendra developed a hypothetical plan, including a number of times per week that they would have tough conversations to seriously address the resentment, and the number of times per week they would create time and space to share non-sexual pleasure. They established some potential ground rules for how these times would go. Coach, okay. Now you have these lists and you have some hypothetical plans. The goal at this point in the process is to choose a simple, really doable plan over which you both feel equal ownership and responsibility. Aim for small changes right now that will give you a lot of success. Can we agree on one more thing? Mike and Kendra, sure. Coach, Kendra is not the diagnosed patient in this situation. Both of you are equally right and healthy, and neither is wrong or broken. What's broken is the connection between you, and repairing the connection will require both of you to invest equally in breaking down this wall of difficult feelings you've built up between you. Mike and Kendra, oof. This is one example of how couples can think pragmatically about difficult situations like this by talking about the feelings and problems without being in the feelings and problems. You take them all out and dump them on the table like puzzle pieces, and you begin sorting. In real life, a conversation like this takes a few hours, often spread out over multiple sessions. What matters most is that each person's autonomy is respected, so that no one feels railroaded into anything and no one feels their needs are being neglected. With kindness, patience, and when necessary, professional support, you can make plans together to get the good stuff and minimize the not-so-good stuff. That's how couples collaborate to co-create a context that makes pleasure easier to access. Healing old hurts. A special characteristic of a long-term relationship is that both partners will inflict wounds on each other over the years and decades, usually accidentally, occasionally deliberately. Therapists know that this is a normal, all but inevitable experience in a long-term relationship. A sex therapist friend of mine described the situation this way. When people are so intimately entwined for such a long period of time, they have access to their partner's most vulnerable points. Maybe they were cheated on. Maybe their partner said something cruel in a bad moment. Maybe they said something that was meant to be helpful, but instead cut deep into an old wound. Both parties want to stay together. They do love each other. They want to have a good sexual connection again. But in those intimate moments, the old pain rears up and shuts down the ability to open up sexually. Even if the hurt is not caused intentionally or maliciously, and even after genuine, heartfelt apologies are made and accepted, once that vulnerable spot has been hit, how does the wounded partner let go of that hurt? Let me be honest. Healing old hurts is not easy for most couples. It's a collaborative process you cultivate over time as you accumulate old hurts and you mutually acknowledge that they have to be dealt with or else your relationship will begin to erode. If you can't deal with old hurts around non-sexual issues in your relationship, you'll probably really struggle when it comes to old sexual hurts. Experiencing flare-ups about that time your partner spent the money you were supposed to be saving and they didn't tell you? Work on that first. Then deal with the time one of you went further than you mutually agreed was acceptable with another partner, or the time someone said something hurtful about the other person's body, sexual history, or ability to give and receive pleasure. You can use the skills I describe here to work on those other issues, then approach a sex-related hurt. Talking about sex can be more difficult than talking about other topics because we were raised to feel both inherently flawed when it comes to sex and, at the same time, existentially mandated to be excellent at sex. Let's use two examples, one with a completely non-sex-related old hurt, a physical injury, and one sex-related old hurt, an emotional injury. The two are exact parallels, and the more we treat emotional wounds the way we treat physical wounds, the easier it is to avoid blame, shame, resentment, and a sense of helplessness. First example. When we were kids, maybe 8 years old, I hit my sister in the face with a baseball bat. She was standing behind me playing catcher as I prepared for our brother's pitch by enthusiastically swinging the bat over my shoulder. Wham! I split her lip and knocked out both of her front teeth. It was an accident. All the examples I'll use are of accidental harm. If the old lingering hurt you're dealing with was intentional, that brings up additional trust issues, so therapy may be worth considering. I felt remorseful. I apologized. None of that could change the fact of her injury. My apology could not stop her lip from bleeding and her face from bruising. My remorse could not end the pain. The fact that it was an accident could not make her teeth grow in. Only time and wound care could do that. In the meantime, over a year as it happened, she had to live without her front teeth. Amelia will never again stand behind me while I'm holding a baseball bat, not because she hasn't forgiven me or because she thinks I did it on purpose, but because her brain very reasonably sends a red alert signal if it notices me with a bat in my hands. And in fact, I haven't voluntarily held a baseball bat in the vicinity of my sister since that day. This is the crucial parallel with emotional wounds. Though the injury itself has healed, it leaves traces in our brain's alert systems, in both the person who was hurt and the person who regrets causing the harm. It's pretty easy to view a physical injury with observational distance, with non-judgment. No one judges Amelia's lip for not healing because I apologized, and no one judges Amelia's brain for hesitating to stand near me if I'm holding a bat. Similarly, if I see Amelia avoid me when I'm holding a bat, no judgment on me for feeling remorse all over again, or shame at having hurt my sister, or defensiveness, or an amorphous frustration that the old harm still resonates into the present. Though my friends would tell me there's no need for that ongoing remorse. Second example, my friends Jamie and Rowan, not their real names, had been married over 10 years, together for nearly 20, when Jamie accidentally criticized Rowan's body. Rowan was sitting on the bed as they got up in the morning, and Jamie, with loving, affectionate intentions, leaned over, grabbed the sides of Rowan's belly, and said, "Beamy." Beamy, like the width of a ship, a broad-beamed ship. Jamie grew up with the family yacht money and competed on his college's sailing team, so for him, nautical terms are a love language. He truly meant it lovingly. He told me later he meant to communicate his pride in his partner's body peace. Rowan's beam was hard won, after all. A non-binary person assigned the "it's a girl" handbook at birth, more on that in chapter 10, Rowan had a painful history with body dysmorphia and disordered eating, which is even more common among trans and non-binary people than cisgender people. And Rowan is of a generation when gender divergence was virtually unaddressed in eating disorder treatment. So their struggle was long and isolating. They had lived a lot of their life with intense depression. It had taken years of emotional work and immersion in a queer community to allow them to have a healthy relationship with food. From that healthy, even joyful relationship with food was born their belly. Rowan had, on one occasion, described that belly as a trophy for practicing self-compassion. But it did not matter that Jamie meant it lovingly. Confronted with the word, along with Jamie's hands right on that long contested part of their body, all the body issues Rowan had ever had in their life rushed to the surface. It was entirely unintentional, just as me clocking my sister in the face was unintentional. Like me, Jamie saw the pain he caused and he felt remorse. He apologized sincerely. That's important, but his remorse and his apology couldn't heal Rowan's hurt, just as mine couldn't heal my sister's lip. What healed Rowan's hurt was the same as what healed my sister's hurt: time and emotional wound care. And in the meantime, Rowan had to live with the wound. But even with great care, even when the wound had healed, Rowan's brain retains traces of red alert, so that when the couple approaches a sexual context, Rowan's brain tells them to brace for impact. If they're in a particularly vulnerable place emotionally, a mere gesture in the direction of the old injury can fully activate the pain, fresh as if it were the day of the original incident. And when Jamie notices Rowan withdrawing, or if Rowan says, "I'm having a boat moment," Jamie's brain activates a similar red alert, the shame or defensiveness or amorphous frustration that the harm continues to resonate into the present. The red alert hits the brakes. No judgment on Jamie for feeling remorse when he sees Rowan's hesitation, though friends would tell him there's no need for ongoing remorse. Got it? Pain resonates into the present not necessarily because a wound is unhealed, but because our brains learn to fear situations that were harmful in the past. The first step to unlearning those fears is non-judgment, both for the time it takes to heal and for the residual red alerts that remain in the wake of harm. From there, you begin the first skill I want to teach here, the third thing conversation. The old hurt is a third thing. It's not a problem that exists inside one partner. It's a shared project, external to each individual and the relationship. Let's take the baseball bat example. Suppose some Labor Day weekend, I visit Amelia, and a bunch of us decide to play softball in the backyard. Suppose I pick up a bat when it's my turn. Amelia's body flares with recognition, and her brain responds with a small red alert of fear. Y'all keep your distance from Emily. She's got a bat, Amelia calls to the family. It's a joke. She's joking, obviously. And I laugh, because what happened was in the past. It was an accident. Her adult teeth grew in. It's fine. But my body flares with recognition of the old hurt, and my brain responds with a small red alert of panic grief. This is all normal. Old emotional junk often arises among family members decades after the original incident. Often, family members can shake it off, let it go, or if they're old school, pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and start all over again. Family! Yay! But sometimes we can't. Suppose the red alert in our brains interfered with our ability to enjoy the holiday. Because Amelia and I have worked hard on our sisterhood and our friendship, we might sit down together at the end of the day and talk about the third thing that is our mutual red alerts, to liberate ourselves from them. Here's my master's degree in counseling interpreting the conversation we would have. Emily names her feeling. When you joked about the bat, I was reminded of the time I caused you harm, and it felt uncomfortable to remember that I have harmed you in the past. Amelia names her feeling. I made the joke because seeing that bat reminded me of the harm you caused. I was uncomfortable and tried to displace the discomfort. We are both doing our best with the resources available to each of us. Calm, warm curiosity. Emily separates the feeling from the past. The event is resolved, yet the emotion lingers, decades later. Still, the fact that I can share that with you is, in itself, healing. Amelia soothes the feeling. I agree, and it helps that we both know how to move all the way through the tunnel of a difficult feeling to get to the light at the end. We can do that together. Emily closes with the tool. I'm grateful we can stay connected, even when it's uncomfortable. Nobody talks like that, right? But this is actually how we, as identical twins on the spectrum, talk to each other. Emily names her feelings. I had a feeling when you joked about the bat. Amelia names her feeling. Yeah, I made the joke because I had a feeling. Calm, warm curiosity. Emily separates the feeling from the past. Feelings are boring. Amelia soothes the feeling. And exhausting. Emily closes with the tool. I chose emotional engagement. Boring and exhausting. Most people's real conversations will be somewhere between the two extremes of therapy speak, where everything is explicit, and twin speak, where everything is spoken in a shorthand incomprehensible to others. But there's a basic structure with important elements that make a third thing conversation effective. Person one names the difficult feeling they're experiencing, puts it on the table. Person two names their difficult feeling, maybe about person one's difficult feeling, puts it on the table. Both turn toward these difficult feelings with calm, warm curiosity. Person one notices that these feelings exist despite the original situation being fully resolved. Person two offers a way out of the difficult feelings unrelated to the original situation, which has already been resolved. You can return to your answers to the questions about your adverse spaces to recall strategies you already know help you move out of them. Person one expresses a blend of admiration, trust, confidence and joy, and the cycle of woundedness to healing. In short, uses a relationship tool or a sex-positive mindset to close the conversation on an unambiguously positive note. Here's a similar kind of conversation between me and my spouse about the reemergence of my low sexual interest. In this instance, I'd been feeling highly self-critical for a number of days, and I finally shared it, knowing that I needed his help to get through this tunnel and find my way to the light. Me names her feeling. Is this an okay time to complain a little bit about how rarely we're having sex? I mean, I realize I'm the problem and I'm complaining about how my own stress is getting in the way of sex, but it really does frustrate me that I can't get out of it. Him names his feeling. You're not a problem. And yeah, I don't like your stress either, and not just because of the sex. I hate seeing you unhappy. Calm, warm curiosity. Me separates the feeling from the past. You know it's not about you. I love you, and I'm attracted to you, and I want to be interested. My brain just can't. Him soothes the feeling. You want to order takeout and watch A Mighty Wind? Me closes with a tool. I chose admiration. How did you know? Our conversation didn't sound this straightforward. I've mentioned before that my spouse's attention moves fast, so there were a lot of tangents and some what-ifs about other situations. It's my role in these serious conversations to return us to our task. Early in our relationship, I was frustrated by this, but I learned quickly that I can have any conversation, discuss any difficult topic, go to the deepest, darkest, scariest emotional places, if I just accept that I am walking through the tunnel with a very excited puppy. He bounces all over while I keep us moving forward. And he's the one who finds the light first and guides me to it. Your conversations may be similarly messy and tangential. All that matters is that you keep the problem as a third thing, not something innate to one or the other of you. My friends Jamie and Rowan are also really great at communicating, but they had a pattern to overcome. They had taken some great advice from a therapist. Don't bring it up in the moment. If the old hurt arises, wait until you're calm to discuss it so that you don't argue while you're already activated with stress. That's generally a great approach. However, as a consequence of it, if the old pain arose when they started to have sex, they either didn't have sex or else, oof, Rowan went ahead and had the sex while also feeling the bad feelings. But after years of talking about it outside the feeling, the old hurt was still popping up and hitting the brakes, especially when Jamie tried to initiate sex, and both of them were frustrated that all their careful processing hadn't gotten rid of it. So I said, talk about it in the moment. When you start feeling it, pause the sex and process the feeling, not to stop the sex, but so that you can eliminate the ambivalence and have sex worth having. I told them my Cohen story, the time I paused things to inquire about potential unwanted consequences, and how, yes, talking about it shifted the experience of desire, but then we could have playful, pleasurable sex without the ambivalence. It did not work the first time they tried. Or even the first few times, it was too difficult to move through the feelings, and they ended up cuddling instead of having the sex they planned. Forgiveness. How to. According to scientists, forgiveness means something like the absence of negative thoughts, feelings, and behaviors toward the transgressor, and perhaps the presence of positive thoughts, feelings, and behaviors toward them. In real life, people mean lots of different things when they use the word forgiveness. Is forgiveness the mere statement of, I forgive you? Is it getting to a place where you no longer invest your energy in negative thoughts and emotions about the person who caused you harm? Is it the reacceptance of the forgiven person into your life? Do you necessarily trust a person you forgive? In my opinion, forgiveness is whatever forgiveness is for you. Forgiveness doesn't even have to be a choice you make or an action you take. As I always say, difficult feelings are tunnels. You go all the way through the darkness to get to the light at the end. Forgiveness can simply be the place you find yourself when you get to the end of the tunnel. Be sure to notice if someone asks for forgiveness and you say, I forgive you, but they're not satisfied. They want more than the forgiveness they got. Maybe they want to restore your relationship to what it was before. Maybe they want to hear you say they didn't do anything wrong in the first place. Maybe they want to know that you love them just the same. None of these things has to be included with your forgiveness, though any of them may be. I forgive you, and I never want to see you again, can be forgiveness. I forgive you for the wrong you did and the harm you caused, can be forgiveness too. I forgive you, and I don't think our love will ever be the same, can be forgiveness. And I forgive you, and our relationship is better because we went through this struggle together, can be forgiveness. Forgiveness doesn't mean the old hurt never comes up again, and the worst thing to do when someone who has forgiven you is once again experiencing the hurt is to say, "But you forgave me." Forgiveness is like love. When you love someone, it simply means you love them. When you forgive someone, it simply means you forgive them for the harm they caused. Whether your relationship is still intact is a separate question. Something to notice about the third thing, curiosity-based approach to dealing with old hurts. No one says, "But I already apologized. What else do you want?" You have successfully decoupled the hurt from the resolved incident. Today's discomfort is not about the past incident, and therefore it's not about who apologized or how. The third thing conversation is about being there for the uncomfortable feelings that are happening right now. My favorite thing about Rowan and Jamie's story is that the moment they made major progress broke the rules I've been describing. It happened when they turned against the third thing. It went something like this. Rowan names their feeling, inarticulate groan into Jamie's chest. Jamie names his feeling, "Not again." Calm, warm curiosity. Rowan separates the feeling from the past. I'm literally just bored at this point. I'm fucking bored of having to deal with this shit. I'm bored trying to be compassionate toward the feeling. Fuck that. I don't love the feeling. I hate the feeling. I'm done with it. Fuck off, feeling. Jamie soothes the feeling. Fuck off, feeling. We're done with you. Rowan closes with a tool. I'm gonna fucking show this feeling. You think you can ruin sex? Not today, Satan. I'm gonna lie, spread eagle on this bed with the lights on, and love the shit out of my body until I come so hard I can't walk. Get on it, babe. The second skill for healing old hurts is something I call the what-if daydream. The tragedy of old hurts is that you can never go back and undo them, however much you wish you could. Or can you? Allow me to introduce you to the what-if daydream. With a what-if daydream, you reimagine the hurt. Imagine it vividly and viscerally. And you imagine for yourself exactly what you needed in that moment of distress. Don't imagine that the hurt never happened. Just imagine that someone had been there for you in an ideal way, fully present, utterly safe and loving, holding you until the pain got a little easier. What if you had been safe in that moment? In the language of the floor plan, the question is, what if the instant the harm happened, all the adverse spaces in your floor plan disappeared? And all you could access were the favorable spaces of seeking, play, lust, and above all, care. Can imagining a different past create real emotional healing in the present? Sure it can. It's our imaginations that activate the red alert signal in anticipation of a potential risk. If our imagination can activate a physiological stress response, that means it can activate a physiological healing response. If you were dealing with physical pain, we might call this kind of fantasy a corrective experience, training your brain to feel safe in the presence of pain. But it works for emotional pain, too. As an example, let's start with my sister's front teeth and her avoidance of me with a bat. She and I would sit together, and she could daydream aloud. Amelia, what if, when you hit me in the face, we already had a perfect caregiver with us? What if our grandmother, as her ideal self, had been there with hugs and a first aid kit and all the compassion in the world? This would be especially powerful because our grandmother died 20 years ago, so we're invoking an ancestor who brings the power of infinite wisdom and kindness. Emily, what if she had been there and used the opportunity to teach me to tend wounds so that I could be a part of the caregiving? She'd tell me to run and get ice, and she'd show me how to put it in a washcloth and then press it to the wound to stop the bleeding. Amelia, we would both be allowed to cry as much as we needed to. And once my mouth stopped hurting, she would feed us her breaded chicken with cheese sauce, which is the most perfect food anyone ever tasted. Emily, then we would make dessert with the Snoopy snow cone machine she got for us, even though we didn't keep our room clean for a whole month. It would feel good on your gums. Even a decades-old harm can benefit from a reimagined, ideal, what-if daydream. Let's apply the daydream to our couple with the hurtful body image comment. They sat on the couch together and tried it. Rowan, what if, in the moment after you said those words, you were gifted with psychic abilities and you could instantly and fully understand all the ways I was impacted? Imagine if I didn't have to do all that explaining. You just knew in an instant about the hurts and insecurity that already lived inside me and the ways your words just echoed down across all of that pain. Jamie, and what if, because I understood right then all the ways you were suffering, I was suddenly a perfect caregiver, fully trustworthy, and knowing exactly what to say and do? Imagine that I had no defensiveness and no guilt, just unlimited love for you. What if I knew exactly the words that would heal those wounds? Not just the one from my words, but all those old wounds from your childhood, and especially the ones from high school. Imagine I could hold you and say exactly the right words. Now, it might have been the case that Rowan suddenly knew exactly the right words, like maybe, I love your body because it's part of you, and that has nothing to do with how it looks. And Jamie could have said that and meant it. But Rowan didn't know the words, so they let the details be vague, even when the emotional experience was specific and intense. Rowan, you say exactly the right words, and my body hears them and believes them. Imagining a past that could never have happened, they actually created the experience right there on the sofa. They held each other and cried. The what-if daydream? It's for people who are ready to imagine a reality that could never have existed in the moment, but is, nevertheless, a reality we can co-create in our shared memory. My sister and I imagined a what-if that could have actually happened, but Rowan and Jamie imagined magic for themselves. What if we had magic? Is a gorgeous use of the what-if daydream because our imaginations aren't limited to the real world. Just as magical metaphors can help trauma survivors to understand their survivorship, what if daydreams can resolve unfinished emotional business with resources that don't exist in real life? It's a shared daydream, not a wish for the past to be different. When I used this practice with my spouse, we imagined that our present-day selves could go back and tell our 8 years ago selves what we now know. We didn't say, if only I had known then what I know now. We said, what if I could go back and tell myself everything I've learned since then? We told each other what we would tell our past selves. And just like that, we felt as if our past selves knew what we had learned and could be at peace. In her book, I Hope We Choose Love, A Trans Girl's Notes from the End of the World, writer and healer Kai Cheng Tom acknowledges the deep bullshit in which our lives are mired and offers a soul-warming, optimistic, and utterly practical solution. Choose love. If you're angry, you have every right to be. Hold your anger with love. If you're despairing, you have every right to be. Hold your despair with love. The hold of love is not a tight fist, but an open palm. Hold your anger, your despair, your loneliness, your fear, in the palms of your hands, like a bird, or a palm full of water from a stream, or an offering of rose petals. Observe them with calm, warm curiosity. Show them to your partner so they too can witness your pain with calm, warm curiosity. Witness the difficult feelings from your internal space of observational distance. Sometimes your partner comes to you with their anger, despair, loneliness, or fear held tenderly in the palms of their hands. If your partner is angry, they have every right to be. Hold their anger with love. If your partner is despairing, they have every right to be. Hold their despair with love. Hello, anger. Hello, despair. I see you. I love you. I want to know you. The tools discussed in this chapter can help you and a partner collaborate on your shared garden. But maybe they feel too complicated, difficult, or out of reach. If that's you, I want to talk to you about the biggest, meanest barriers between you and the long-term sexual connection you're longing for. Regardless of your relationship structure or the genders of the people involved or your ages or anything else, you were raised in a culture full of people who had opinions. And they very much expect you to agree with those opinions and organize your life around them. We'll use all the tools and science we've described so far to overcome this barrier made of other people's opinions. I think of it as two parts: the sex imperatives and the gender mirage. They're the topics of the next two chapters. Chapter 8, TLDR. 1. Intentional change happens gradually. It can be cultivated, but never forced. People don't change faster because we get more impatient with them. 2. How you approach a partner with a change should be shaped by where they are in their readiness to change, pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, or maintenance. You can facilitate change one step at a time. 3. In any relationship that lasts long enough, partners will experience emotional wounds that persist long after the incidents that caused them are over. They heal the way physical injuries heal, with time and care. Apologies and remorse are important, but they can't knit a person back together. Instead, what works is turning toward the old wound as a third thing, a shared project that partners want to heal together. 4. These old injuries last because of the fear we associate with the original injury rather than because of ongoing harm. Our well-intentioned imagination makes the pain linger. That means we can use our imaginations to free ourselves from the fear through a what-if daydream. Some good questions. If my partner wanted me to make a change, how would I want them to approach me? What is it that each of us wants from change? How will we know when enough change has happened? What genuinely is at stake when it comes to creating change? Would a partner leave the relationship if the situation isn't resolved to their satisfaction? Can we separate solving the problem itself from the process of dealing with all the feelings each person has about the problem? Might we even start feeling better about each other before we've finished creating the change we want? What do our floor plans tell us works to help each person move through an adverse space into a positive space?